Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Hello, Fiona.
Hi, Gail. You are looking very cheerful for someone who has apparently not been writing this week.
You know what they say, fake it till you make it, all those things. So maybe I'm doing that. But yeah, I am struggling with the balance and finding time to write and finding energy to write. And, you know, I'm a great one for saying to people, it's not hard. You just make 10 minutes, write 200 words a day, and that's a book a year. And I'm really quite dictatorial about it. I'm constantly telling people that I cannot carve out that 10 minutes at the moment. I don't know what my problem, and it's not that I don't have ideas. I'm full of ideas. I'm full of what I should be doing next. I'm full of creative energy, but I'm not managing to make that time. The great irony of this is one of my ideas is to write a non-fiction book about how to make time for creativity in a busy life. But I can't do it. So I better put that idea aside until I can do it myself. But yeah, crap week. What about
okay,
you?
Okay, so no, I want to unpack this a bit because the last we heard you were working on a play. Are you doing any Katie Gale writing or editing? Where are you in the novel space? What do you think's going on?
So, okay, part of it, thank you. You've already made me feel better. Part of it is to do with Katie Gale. We've been going through the editing phases and they come very quickly. You know, you do the copy edit and then a week later you've got the proofread back and now you've got to write the dedication and things like that. So we've been deep in that and I have been doing that and I have been reading a lot of Katie Gale as we go. You know, I've been working on my part of the Katie Gale writing process. So maybe it is that when I do have those 10 minutes, that's what I have to use it on rather than on something of my own. The play is there. I know what I want to do. It's finding the time. And the play takes me a little bit more time because I'm not used to writing a play. And then the novel writing, Fiona, I'm not even going to go into that. But the ideas and things percolating. I've got a half-written novel that I need to go back to. Mm-hmm. I've got a thing that's out on submission that I need to go back to. And there's a lot of needing to go back. I suspect at the end of this year, I'm going to look back at it as a year of editing rather than a year of writing, which is not my best. I like that real deep in the trenches writing phase best. But I suppose you have to have the other things as well. What about you? Have you had better luck than me?
Well, I have taken my novel out of mothballs I am busy reworking it. And at the time that I was writing it, I thought I was being so careful and intentional and that the characters that I was starting with were exactly as they would be when I finished with them. And that there wasn't going to be this major disjuncture. But now that I've gone back after a couple of months of letting it lie fallow, I've realized that I didn't know exactly where I was going when I started this out, and I hadn't got the tone of all the characters quite right. So it's kind of fun to have the chance to sort of retro-engineer at this stage and make sure that from the very beginning, I'm writing towards my goal and that there aren't these inconsistencies in character. Okay. Because now I read what I've written and I go, oh, no, she would never say that. She would never do that thing. I know her much better as a character and I can go back and make those changes and write towards the way that I know she really is meant to be. So that's kind of a fun process.
Fiona, do you think if we were the kind of people who wrote a 5-page character synopsis before we started writing, that kind of thing would be avoided? Or do you think it would still happen in the writing, you'd discover who the character really was?
I suspect for me that it would still happen because as much as you plot it out carefully in advance, your characters still have the capacity to surprise you and to go off in directions that weren't 100% what you planned from the beginning and that you realize, oh no, this is actually better. So it's nice to be able to make sure that I'm consistent from the beginning in this book.
I'm relieved. I don't want to have to write 5-page character synopses.
So what have you been reading or writing or listening to during this period?
Okay, so I've got a confession because we know I'm bad at TV. I'm very, very late to a very popular party. I might be the only person at the party at this point, but it's the Ted Lasso party. Mm-hmm. I think everyone else listened to it during watched it during lockdown or something. But oh my God, it's so fun. It is just so fun. I'm in the third season now. I've heard people debating which season's the best. I think the third season might be the best, and I'm loving it. Have you watched it?
I have not quite got into it.
Really?
I watched two or three episodes, and I could see, okay, this is interesting and quirky, but it didn't grab me by the throat and force me to carry on. So at some time when I am scratching around wondering what to watch next, I'm definitely going to go back to it. Because I know everybody says it's wonderful, so I have to make myself like it.
I do find if I've abandoned something after an episode or two, the chances of me picking it up are really very, very, very slim. So I'll be interested to know if you manage that.
Well, I'll let you know. I'll definitely let you know.
So what have you been reading, listening to, watching?
I have been reading James by Percival
Everett. Oh, you're so intellectual. Fiona, you make me feel so stupid.
I have been making an effort lately. This is not the usual me.
War and Peace, James.
So this book was just awarded the Pulitzer, and it's a reimagining of the character of Jim from Huckleberry Finn. And I went into it really wanting to love it unreservedly, and I do love it, and I have a couple of reservations, and I'm not sure if it's just me, if as a privileged middle-class white woman, I have any right to comment on this book, because this is a black man writing about a very painful period in black history, and to step in as a white woman and say, oh, I don't think you did this properly, you know. That's not something that I want to be doing. But there's an interesting thing. He talks about the way the enslaved people in the American South would have presented a different face to white people to what they presented to each other.
Yes.
And the kind of code switching that they would have practiced, the different words they would have used, the different register, the way they would speak to each other versus how they would be seen speaking to each other for the white gaze. And it's all fascinating and incredibly valid. But he paints the vernacular English of enslaved people as something that they put on to sound stupid. And I need to get my head around this, because the linguist in me does not believe that any language or register or vernacular is superior to another. Vernacular English to me is as valid as the King's English or the Queen's English, as it might have been at the time. And I totally believe that code switching and vocabulary switching would have happened. But to paint any vernacular as trying to sound dumb sits uneasily with me. And I've been scratching around on the internet trying to find out if anybody else has this problem.
Yeah.
I feel like linguists would have something to say about it. And again, I don't like to pose myself as a white woman saying, oh no, you shouldn't have done this. And also, I'm very open to the idea that I may be misunderstanding something here.
Okay.
So it's just interesting. I'd love people to chime in and correct me here.
Well, I wonder if you can find linguistic research on this phenomenon, because he must have based this on something. My understanding is it's a very thoughtfully written book.
Yes. But so a lot of historical research that clearly went into it.
Maybe you must be scratching around rather than looking for other people's views, looking for the linguistic view on that time in history and that particular vernacular.
Yeah.
A more academic research is needed here, Fiona.
I'll get on to it, Gail.
You could write a paper if you wanted to.
Well, somebody whose work lends itself to cheerful reviews and to academic papers is our guest today. Our guest today is Alistair Mackay. Alistair is the author of the dystopian novel, It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, Also the novel The Child, and now most recently the short story collection The Lucky Ones. Alistair's work has been shortlisted for the British Science Fiction Association Awards, Brittle Papers 100 Notable African Books of 2022, nominated for the Sunday Times Fiction Prize, a finalist in the Lambda Literary Awards of 2017 for Best LGBTQ Anthology. I could actually go on and on, but I'm going to stop there.
For the sake of our egos, Fiona, let's stop
yes,
there.
Yes, let's pretend those were all the awards that Alistair's been nominated for. Alistair, we're so happy to have you in the studio with us today. Hello and welcome.
Hi, thank you, Fiona. Hi, Gail. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's really wonderful to be here.
It's always exciting when someone... We don't even ask for fans. We just ask for people to have maybe listened to one or two.
No, I don't Alistair, think I've missed any. So.
As a fan, you know where we're going.
You're going to ask me how my writing week was.
That's exactly what we're going to ask you.
And I have
please
a very disappointing answer for you, I'm afraid. It has not been a writing week at all. I'm up in Joburg this week for the Kingsmead Book Fair, which is tomorrow. And so it's that time of year where a lot of writers are very busy with marketing of their books rather than actually writing anything new. It's been one of the projects that I'm working on for my day job has been very busy recently. But I have been wrapping up the audiobook recording of The Child. I don't know if that counts as writing, but that was really, really fun to do. And that finished up this week. So narrating my book. I don't know if that counts as a writing
you
project.
You narrated it yourself.
Yes. Yeah, I did. Which I thought would be terrifying. I thought it would be a lot like public speaking, but I actually loved it. I really loved it. I kind of got into this zone of feeling, I guess, what a voice actor feels like, but it was just between me and the book and in this closed space. And it felt so different reading it out loud to having written it down.
I'm very curious about this.
Yes, me too. Please break this down for us.
Okay.
Whose idea was it to have you do it? Have you done any voice work before? And break it down for us, like going into a studio or recording from home. What did you do? How exactly does that happen? Because we are so interested.
Yeah, it was my idea. I suppose we did go back and forth about whether to get a voice actor or to do it myself. The one consideration is obviously that it's a bit cheaper to do it yourself. You don't have to hire a voice actor. But I also spoke to a lot of my friends and asked them if they enjoy listening to audiobooks in the voice of the author. And most people said yes, they actually prefer it if they can to hear the author read the work. So I thought, well, let me try and put on my big boy pants and try do it myself. I haven't had any voice training, but the studio that recorded me were lovely. The guy, he sort of directs you and he stops you if he says if I'm going too fast or if I miss a word. He literally follows on a screen, word for word, everything I'm saying. And if I say a there's instead of a there is, like that level of detail, then you say, no, we've got to redo that. So there's someone who's kind of making sure that it's going well. But yeah, there was no formal training or anything. I was just reminding myself to slow down because I know I speak fast when I'm nervous. And I had my mom's voice in my head saying, don't mumble. So, but there was no formal training. But I got into the flow of it, I suppose, like all things. I think the first session was maybe a little bit, it wasn't that bad, but it was a little bit ropey. And then I kind of just got into it and I started feeling into it. And turns out I can sight read okay. I got quite emotional during certain parts of the book, but I think that's maybe quite nice for the listeners for me to be moved by the certain passages. Yeah.
And I'm very curious because I strongly suspect I would hate my writing read aloud and I'd go, why did I structure the sentence like this? Why did I use that word? Also, I sometimes use words I can't pronounce, so that would have been a problem. Did you have anything like that?
100%. So, yes. So, the part of why I noticed that he was keeping track on the screen was because I think when I do a reading at like a book launch or whatever, I sometimes skip like a line or change a word or something because I'm like, oh, maybe this would be a little bit better in the moment. And you're just not allowed to do that because it has to be what was written. So it was quite stressful, but then it became quite freeing. I think that was one of the things that I let go of. And I like almost forgot that I was the writer and I was just the voice actor. You know, I was like, well, this is the material that I'm working with and let me try and make it sing. And a few times I had to stop him and say, can you please just Google how to pronounce that word?
I'm so relieved I'm not the only one.
It made me feel a little bit pretentious, but they're like sort of normal words that I see all the time written down. But
yes,
you don't hear them in speech, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And did you do different voices for different characters?
Again, because I'd sort of asked my friends beforehand what were some of the like tips they had for me. A lot of people get really annoyed when a when an author does that. Apparently, they well, so I guess it's a question of degree, because I think you do need to a little bit try and differentiate the voices. But I think it can seem a bit ridiculous if the one's like really high pitched and really like, you know, strange. So I tried to subtly differentiate the voices, but not too much. I didn't do like accents or anything like that.
That was going to be my next question. Like Sibs.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, there's some closer characters in the book. So, yeah, I chose not to.
Yeah, no, I think that could be a dangerous, dangerous place to go to doing different accents.
Yeah, I think especially in South Africa, I think it could land very badly.
Yeah. I'm going to ask what Fiona normally asks, which is when you've had a not a typical writing week, what does your typical writing week look like?
When I'm working on a project and when I'm fully in a project, working on a creative project, I'm an early morning person. I need to get up early before distractions. In winter, it's even better if it's pitch black outside and I feel like no one's woken up and the whole world is silent. And I go down into a little home office, and my goal is not, words, because it's so inconsistent. Some days I'm quite, prolific, and some days I get it's like pulling teeth trying to get anything onto the page. So I just sit at my desk for a certain amount of time. I usually try to be there for like 2 or 3 hours, and I don't let myself leave until those 2 or 3 hours are up, kind of regardless of how well it's going. And if it's not going well, of course the urge to get up and leave is even stronger. And go make myself a cup of tea or just check. So I have to leave my
phone. Are you not allowed the cup of tea?
I might let myself have a cup of tea once an hour. But I won't. I'll try to put my phone in the other room, because that's the worst thing for me. It's so hard to fight the pull of my phone. Checking Instagram, whatever it is. So I just try and get rid of all the distractions. And then, those are my quiet moments when my brain is still functioning. From mid-afternoon, I think my brain is useless. So.
And if it goes really, really well, how many words do you get done in that time?
It's still probably not a lot. I don't know if I've ever actually counted, but my problem with writing, I know a lot of writers, they go in and they kind of write so much stuff and then they've got to come back and edit it and trim it back. I'm the exact opposite. I struggle to get the words out, and I struggle to not edit as I'm going and to try and make each sentence perfect, which I know you're not supposed to do, and I know it interrupts your flow. So I really try not to do that, but it's still, I do try and push myself to just get more words out. So it's very seldom that it'll just flow from me, and then I come back and trim it. So the word count, I don't think, is very impressive.
And when did you first know that you wanted to be a writer? When did that knowledge come to you? And did you intentionally start crafting your life towards that goal? Because I know that you've done literary courses, you've done an MA in creative writing.
I think I've actually always wanted to be a writer. I loved writing when I was little. I wrote I think probably a lot of kids do this, but my mom still got them. It's quite sweet, like a bunch of illustrated books that I wrote when I was like 5, 6 years old. I always loved the idea of being a writer, and I wrote the whole way through school. But I think, like a lot of people, I didn't really think it was possible to actually make that your career or your what you do with your life. It can kind of be a hobby, and maybe even more so in South Africa. I don't know if I'd seen a lot of South African writers at that point. So I was a little bit all over the place in my early adulthood. I was trying to do something creative with my life, also trying to do something useful and, something that's valued by capitalism, and trying to find what that is. So I studied politics for my undergrad degree, but then I didn't feel like that was creative enough for me. So then I went into architecture school. I thought that's a nice way of being, creative and useful. But I ended up in marketing, and in the marketing roles that I had, I was doing more and more writing, kind of content writing and copywriting and that kind of stuff. And that really reminded me how much I, love it. Yet it wasn't quite enough. So I suppose so that was sort of when I started deciding maybe I can actually make a proper go of this. And then, sorry to get a bit heavy, but then my dad passed away when I was 28. And that was kind of a reminder that life is short and that we've got to sort of follow our dreams if we want to achieve them, there's not an infinite amount of time. So he passed away, and so I took some of the money that I inherited from him, and I went to go study creative writing because I didn't feel confident enough to just write a book. I didn't feel like I had the skills. I don't feel like I'd read enough. So I needed sort of some hand-holding. So I went to go study an MFA in creative writing in New York. And that was just the most unbelievable experience for me. It was being in New York itself is just such an amazing city. You meet such incredible writers. There's just so many literary figures who live there, and they'll be doing events basically every week. You just can't go down to the 92nd Street Y, whatever, you'll see, you know, like Joyce Carol Oates giving a reading or whatever, just like every day of the week. You don't even need to plan these things. And the faculty there is huge. So I think there were like 15 to 20 like pretty famous writers on the faculty. So it was very hard work. I didn't see much of New York during those 2.5 years, because during term time you're reading, I think we had to read, geez, I think 100 novels per year, plus each other's work all the time. You're sitting in workshop every week. You're producing either a short story or a chapter for a novel. And then every week there's a 3-hour workshop where three people in the group, and there were 12 of us per workshop, where three people get reviewed, and they sit, and you sit there for the full hour, and you're not allowed to say a word while people critique your work.
Yeah. I was just thinking this sounds wonderful and dreamlike, and I'm like, oh.
So it does thicken your skin a little bit, I guess, although I don't think my skin is still that thick. I don't think I can handle bad reviews very well. But it, yeah, and you also learn to what feedback you find useful and what to ignore. And I suppose they're in the same boat in that they're also trying to be writers, and they also are hoping that you'll give them useful feedback. So they try and make it as constructive as possible. And it was just such a freeing experience, because not only was I exposed to so many new writers and new ways of writing, but it's so experimental, you know, because you're having to produce just so much work. I like played around a bit, and I tried different styles, and I tried different, you know, like historical fiction and speculative fiction and short stories and novellas and all of that, because you have to keep producing. So it's nice to keep experimenting with stuff. And
did anything that we have seen published come out of that MFA?
So my thesis was a very early version of It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, my first novel. Although it's a weird, I don't think any of us can even explain how writing works. It's like it takes place in a part of the brain that I don't really understand. Because even though I found it so useful during my workshop in the course, I basically threw out that version of It Doesn't Have to Be This Way after the course and started again. But I think stuff had percolated, stuff had fallen into place in my mind, because then once I started again, once I'd moved home to South Africa, it did sort of flow. And like a lot of the stuff that I was really struggling with it in terms of structure just made sense intuitively. So it was kind of my thesis, but it was a very different book. It had different characters in it. The world was the same. I think I was very interested in the world of that book. And the part that I struggled with was how to get the characters that both exemplify what I want to show in the world and also that readers like fall in love with and, you know, resonate with. So that was the tricky part of that. And actually, one or two of the stories in The Lucky Ones, my most recent book, I also wrote during, I think, two of them.
Okay.
The two that are set in New York. I wrote while I was living in New York.
So It Doesn't Have to Be This Way is a dystopian novel. And yeah. I'm always interested to know, as a South African writer of dystopian fiction, do you feel as though you are under the shadow of someone like Lauren Bierkes? Or is she just an inspiration? Or did that not come into your thinking at all at the time?
It very much did come into my thinking. It was much more on the positive side of things. So for me, it was wonderful when I discovered Lauren's books. It was quite a while ago now. I think I was probably still in my early 20s. I can't remember when Moxieland came out. But I loved Moxieland. And it was so, it was like, oh, wow, we can do this. South Africans can also do this. So for me, I found it like very freeing. I didn't feel under her shadow at all. It was wonderful. Because before that, a bit of what I was hinting at earlier, I don't think I read a lot of South African books growing up. And so it almost seemed like this impossible thing to be a South African writer. It's like, oh, no, that's for people from America or for people from Britain. So it was really cool to see someone doing really great speculative fiction from South Africa, set in Cape Town even.
Reading about your writing leading up to this pod, I came across a term that I've never heard before describing a genre, eco-narrative.
Okay.
Apparently your writing is eco-narrative. I've I've written three letters, one of them being W, one of them being F. Please can you tell us what eco-narrative means?
Well, I don't think anyone knows what that first book is. No one knows where to put it. It was quite funny when it came out. It was in all different sections of the bookshop. Because it's dystopian. It's an eco-narrative. It's also a queer story, which a lot of people think of as a very separate thing. So it's all the genres kind of blended into one. I probably should have thought more about how to market it while I was writing it. I guess eco-narratives are stories, the way I understand it anyway, I'm not the expert.
You are the expert.
I'm very much not the expert. I guess there's stories where the climate crisis is central to what's happening in the story. And it doesn't have to be this way. It's set in Cape Town in the near future, where the water has run out and the droughts have become so severe that there's frequent
very
famine.
Very near future.
Very near future, yeah. I was accelerating the timeline for dramatic effect, and then some like pretty severe weather things happened after it came out that made me think, oh, maybe I didn't accelerate it so much. And that nearness was part of the thing that finally clicked into place for me. So the earlier draft of this book, I couldn't make it work because I didn't realize that I could actually just move around in time. So for some reason, I didn't realize that. So I was trying to tell stuff in backstory and it wasn't working. And then I was like, hang on. I think moving back to South Africa, I moved back at the same time as the Day Zero crisis in Cape Town. And there was that countdown clock. Remember the countdown to Day Zero. And I think that gave me the idea for the structure of it doesn't have to be this way. Because I was like, oh, I'm going to have a countdown clock and you're going to go from like the present day until, and then you see how many years until this really terrible future. And it's 15 years and then it's 9 years and then it's...
You know, for some people it was a terrible disaster counting down the water. For you it was inspiration.
Totally.
Everything has a good side for someone.
I mean, I found the COVID lockdowns incredibly productive too. So maybe I'm a sucker for punishment.
I noticed in your most recent collection, The Lucky Ones, that you returned to the theme of climate crisis. Mm. How did that idea or that sort of source of inspiration for narrative, how did it grab you? Is it something you've studied or was it a personal anxiety of yours? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I think a bit of both. So as I mentioned, I studied politics for my undergrad degree, and one of the modules that we did in third year was I can't remember what it's called. Green political thought is what it was called. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like the philosophy of ecological movements and what's happening in terms of CO2 emissions and global warming. And at the time, some of the predictions were so dire, and yet it really wasn't mainstream. It wasn't kind of in the news ever. I think I have a bit of a apocalyptic bent. I don't know. I'm often looking for crises. Maybe it's childhood trauma. I don't know. But I'm always looking for what's going wrong. And so I was very drawn to that because it seemed like there was this huge disconnect between a very scary scenario that's quite, at the time, very probable. Hopefully we're doing some things about it now. And it just wasn't in the news, really. So I wanted to write an eco-narrative, to use your term. I thought it would be really important, but I also thought it would be quite fun. I don't know if it's weird to say it's fun to write a dystopian novel, but it's quite fun to imagine, I don't know, your city and going through something very different and imagining how it will play out in society and all the kinds of things that it'll do to people. I don't know. It was very creatively stimulating.
I can see it as fun, but then I also found The Walking Dead quite calming.
The thing with horror is I love horror books. I've read quite a few of them, but I can't watch horror. I just can't. It's too much for me. I suppose you can't close it and put it down again like you can at the book.
And you can't edit the visual like you can in your own head.
Yeah.
I'm interested in, you're a writer who definitely, you expose yourself in your writing. Mm. You've talked about how you became emotional reading back your own writing. How do you weigh that up? How do you decide how much of yourself to put out there, how raw to be, and how do you feel about having done it?
Ooh, that last question. if you'd asked me this a year ago, I would have had a very different answer for you. I'm still very glad I did it. Okay, let me start with how I feel choosing to do it. It was kind of a compulsion for me. I think the stuff that I wanted... So I presume you're referring to The Child, which was a very, very personal novel. I think it was a compulsion. I felt like there was stuff I needed to work through. I'd written a short story in The Lucky Ones, actually, where I'd sort of lent dealt with her very anxious main character. And I wasn't done with it yet. I wanted to really lean into it. And I know I love reading books that feel very raw and very emotional. Like I loved Ocean Vuong's On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. I don't know if you guys have read that. I felt kind of tearful the whole way through that book. I loved A Little Life, which we spoke about a little bit earlier. So I love books like that. And so I wanted to try and be as brave as I could while I was writing this stuff. I think I started writing The Child in COVID, and I have a writing group. We no longer really exist, but at the time we had a writing group, and we would share stuff with each other once every 2 weeks. And so it started with that, and it started with just kind of vignettes, and I didn't really know where I was going with it yet. And so it didn't, I don't think I appreciated how scary it would be for a broader audience to see that stuff. So I was trying to write stuff. I was exploring certain things around mental health and how we process trauma and how we heal and all of these quite heavy things. And I wanted to write about it, and I was really enjoying writing about it. And then I started thinking, oh, this can work as a novel. And I started to put together all the sort of the strands that would tie it together so that it's not just an incoherent set of vignettes. Yeah, but I think I always do this thing with my writing where I almost pretend no one's going to read it until quite far down the line. I think I have to, actually. I can't think about the reader. I would find it far too inhibiting. And I also, I can't remember who said it, but there was a thing about how you must lean into the places that are uncomfortable. You must lean into the pain when you're writing. And so I try really hard to do that. And in some ways, it was really liberating, because I am quite an anxious person, and I'm always overthinking everything, and I'm always thinking, oh, should I have said that, or should I have done this? And so it's quite nice to just like, actually, I'm going to do it. I'm going to say all the things that I think but don't say. You know, I think there's a lot of stuff that we filter, and so I was really trying to be unfiltered in that. And I loved it, and writing The Child was quite a healing process for me, actually. I think it did. I know there's a whole debate about whether writing is a form of therapy or whether it just re-traumatizes you. I think it's kind of a bit of both. I think you need to be at a certain point before you can try and write about stuff like that. But writing about the main character's journey in that book kind of did heal me in a way, I think. Almost because of the pressures of narrative, there needs to be a change. He can't be the same mess he is in the beginning by the end of the book. He's either got to get worse or get better, I suppose. And so, and that sort of helped me think about some of my own stuff differently. But the second part of your question about how do I feel having done it, it was very difficult to talk about this book in like a public way. And you guys know, like, the main way of marketing books is through like literary events and launches and things like that. There's a lot of public speaking that comes with the job, which I didn't realize came with the job when I started. And I found it very difficult. I had some actually quite bad mental health wobblies last year as a result of it, feeling like I'd share too much or feeling very exposed and very raw. So it wasn't all good, but I still am glad I did it, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about therapy for a moment, because it comes up in a lot of your stories. And it's such an interesting thing, because when you're in therapy, you are turning your life into narrative to present it to your therapist.
Yeah.
And then in writing about therapy, there's an additional sort of meta layer of narrative where you're writing about the process of turning your life into narrative to tell it to a fictional therapist.
Yes.
So talk to us about therapy as a thing that exists in your fiction.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. It's so interesting. So I think therapy I think it's essential. I think everyone should be doing it, firstly.
I agree.
And it is, as you said, it's all about stories. I don't think I kind of realized that going in. But I think how we make sense of ourselves is all about stories. And so the stories that we tell ourselves about our childhood, the stories we tell ourselves about our parents. And for me, in therapy, a lot of that has changed, and I realized, you know, you kind of come up with a whole new story while you're in therapy about what actually happened, and also giving yourself permission to feel quite strongly about things, even if you're an unreliable narrator, like even if you don't remember it in the same way that someone else remembers it. And so, yeah, writing about it, I suppose, is you get another go. You're like, okay, well, I've sort of worked through some of this stuff, and now I'm going to work through some more of this stuff. But then you can also think about it as a writer and what works well in terms of how you can expose certain behaviors, or how you can expose like growth. There's a show called Wanderlust, I think it was called. I don't know if you guys ever watched it, but it had Toni Collette in it. And one of the episodes, and it was about also about repressed memories and trauma, something terrible had happened, if I remember correctly, that she had forgotten all about. But one of the episodes, it was a whole hour long episode, and the camera didn't leave her face, and it was just her in therapy talking. And I was like, that is the most powerful thing I think I've ever seen. And so it showed me just how amazing therapy can be as a storytelling technique if you do it well. I don't know if that was a great answer. I don't know if I know how to do it well, but I keep being drawn to it. I think it's also an area where humans are quite raw and quite vulnerable. And so, yeah, you can get to like beneath the small talk and stuff, get to the real meat of relationships.
I love that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I feel like it's given me too much to think about, and now we need to stop and pause while I think. Okay, I'm going to lighten things. Mm-hmm. Fiona wanted to talk about writing about therapy. I want to talk about writing sex. And we've had Joe Watson tell us about watching porn to write sex, which was a very interesting
and pausing
episode.
It and taking note of who's when he's doing what.
Hilarious. I love that.
So I want to know how you go about writing sex.
it's excruciating, and yet I keep doing it to myself, so I don't know what's going on there. There's this writer that I love called Garth Greenwell. He's an American writer, and he also writes very explicit sex scenes. So the sex in my books, I think, is quite explicit. My mom's always horrified when she reads my books.
skip.
Yeah, exactly. And he always says this thing, which is that he wants to write books that are 100% pornographic. 100% pornographic and 100% high art. And so I guess that's what I try to do. I think sex is obviously an important part of life. We all do it. It's also, I think, for fiction writing and for characters, a really revealing way of showing stuff about characters. You know, what they fantasize about is it's very revealing. And like how people behave during sex, I think, is very revealing in terms of character. So it's also useful for character development. It's not just
that's your story.
Exactly. So I think you can explore some kind of interesting psychological stuff while you're writing sex scenes. But I also do think one of my professors in the writing course that I did said to us, you know, your characters have worked hard, let them have a roll in the hay, you know, like just give them a moment to just have some fun, you know. So yeah, I think I didn't know this beforehand. I didn't know that I was going to be the kind of writer that leaned into it like that, because I forget the term. I think it's a closed door romance.
Yes.
You know, the kinds of books where, you know, you just don't see what happens once.
Fade to black
kind of thing. And I don't want to do that. I want to, maybe it's again leaning into the uncomfortable stuff. I want to show it.
Follow them in.
Take there.
Notes.
Yeah. And sometimes it's kind of really awkward and excruciating, and sometimes it can be really tender and beautiful and show love in action, you know.
Very interesting.
To return for a moment to It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, I want to talk about world building, because that book opens not in the present day where we see how this all unfolded. It opens in the future where Cape Town and the world has changed beyond recognition. And you need to kind of drip feed us some details about what has happened, what does this world look like, who are the people involved, and a lot happens in that first opening chapter. Can you talk us through the decisions that you made there and how you think people should approach this world building thing?
Sure. So the world building was the part that came most easily for me, actually. That's with It Doesn't Have to Be This Way. I could imagine it so clearly for some reason. I could foresee a really bad situation. So yeah, this is part of the structural stuff that I was struggling with, is that I could see that so clearly, but then I kind of needed to tell the story of how we get there. And like, so then going back into time and telling the stories from kind of current times where things are very recognizable. And there's a beautiful, I think, tension between that. So then I wanted to start the book with things looking pretty dire and Cape Town being very barren and very depressing. And then to jump back and it's the Cape Town that we all know and love, and it's scenes with normal people that we all interact with every day. And so that contrast creates that kind of tension. With world building itself, I don't know, do I have advice for people? I suppose just try and be as consistent as possible. It is tricky. I think any kind of speculative fiction, you don't want to overburden the reader with too many details early on in it. But I think sometimes in fantasy books, you see, you know, they introduce so many concepts early on, and this kind of magic and that kind of magic, and I feel like I need to start taking notes because I'm not going to remember who can do what and what power this person has. And so I don't think dystopia is quite like that, thankfully. But I was wary of putting too many details in too fast. I guess it's quite a short scene that the book opens with, so. I had to be selective about what are some quite arresting things that could happen in that moment. And it's dire. I mean, the young boy is hiding under the bed because it's too hot to move around and his parents have gone missing. And I think just in that very close scene, you can reveal so much about the world, you know, about what he's worried about and what he's interacting with.
I think that sounds like very good general writing advice, not just for fantasy and a different world, but generally. I've recently read a book where on the first page all the information was dumped, and I was like, oh, this is why they tell us not to info dump.
Yes.
Okay, I get it now. I want to talk a little bit about short stories, because you've written a lot of short stories. Mm-hmm. You've published short stories all over the place. So I've got two aspects. I want to know about your idea seeds for short stories and how you know that that's a short story idea seed and not a long story idea seed.
Okay. Well, firstly, on the publishing all over the place, I think I need a lot of affirmation. And publishing novels doesn't cut it because it takes so long between each one. So short stories are a great way of getting something published in the space between novels, I suppose, and get a little bit of a... Yeah, get a bit of a dopamine hit, you know, like, oh, God, I've published something this year. So,
I'm going to ask more about that in a second.
So where are the ideas? So I again, don't really know. I think it's all subconscious, but I do keep a notes folder on my phone. So I love to people watch, and I will often write things down on my phone. People think I'm texting, but I'm actually writing down notes about what's happening in the room. Another thing I loved about New York was just riding the subway and seeing such diverse characters, you know, and then my mind just wanders and I imagine what their lives are like and what their story is. So I think being out in public is probably my best idea generator, just people watching and imagining things. And... I don't know how I know whether it's a novel or a short story. I guess a short story for me feels more like a moment in someone's life. I'm trying to capture, like a moment, almost like a scene. It doesn't have to be a scene. It can be a couple of days or whatever, but a period in someone's life or an experience. And it feels very complete at the end of that, which I know irritates some people about short stories. One of my best friends was like, I'm so annoyed you've written a short story collection, because every one of them, I was enjoying it and I wanted to find out more. And I'm like, oh, okay. No, I feel like that was the right amount that you know about this person.
Although that's a sign of a good short story when you want to stay in that world.
Yeah.
You know that you've read a good short story.
Yeah, I suppose so.
So that friend was actually giving me the highest compliment.
maybe how I know it needs to be a bigger project is when I've written something that is kind of a story and it doesn't feel like I'm done with it. It still keeps haunting me, you know. When I've written a story that I'm happy with, I'm done with it. I know I'm done with it. It's I'm satisfied and it makes me feel the way I want it to make me feel. And the novels haunt me and don't let me sleep and don't let me think about anything else. And I guess they're also just inherently much more complicated. There's multiple storylines and so there's a lot more going on in your head, and all of those strands have to not necessarily be resolved in a satisfying way, but they've got to have some kind of resolution.
What I really want to know about is how do you go about getting those short stories published, because I don't find it easy. I don't know where to go and I don't know how to make it happen. Teach me.
A lot of desperation.
take me.
No, I think, yeah, you do just have to try everywhere. So I had a friend in the course with me who said that she doesn't think it's been a successful year for her as a writer unless she's had 100 rejections. So I was like, that's an interesting way of, you know, thinking about how much we should be pitching things. Yes. and submitting things. And I can't do it. I do feel quite disheartened after, you know, I don't know, a number of rejections. Gave up trying to find an agent because of that. But South Africa's short story publishing ecosystem is not that big. There were a few publications that were kind of flash in the pan and produced some cool magazines, but then didn't last. But I've had a lot of luck with New Contrast. I don't know if you know New Contrast. I think they're a great magazine, and they've been going forever. And they've published 3 of my stories. And Brittle Paper publishes short fiction. So there's a few like African. Yeah, I'll give you a list.
Let me make a list.
And then there's also a few anthologies that. That pop up every few years. And I actually haven't been in any of them, but I know there's like Short Sharp Stories and those kinds of anthologies.
Those aren't theme though, so you have
those
to. The theme has to work for you.
That's why I've never got on them either. Yeah. I tried really hard actually. The last one, I just couldn't make it work for some reason. I would have thought I would love writing towards a theme, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I find sometimes the theme resonates for me and it makes me like vomit out a story.
Yeah,
and sometimes it's like no.
Yeah.
So, Alistair, I've seen you described as a queer writer and a writer of queer fiction.
Okay.
And those are two things that are not identical, but certainly overlap. Can you talk to us about writing queer fiction and the way in which queerness intersects in South Africa with all the other potential identities, political, economic, social, racial, ethnic, cultural, etc.?
Sure, that's a big topic. And I have very mixed feelings about all of it. Queer fiction. So I'm always nervous to use that term because I think it puts some people off. And I think someone literally said to me at an event I did the other day, he's like, oh, when are you going to stop writing about queer people? And I was like, oh, okay. So... I think some people can assume it means it's not for them. You know, there's nothing. Probably I shouldn't do. I'm doing air quotes. I know this is. There's no visuals for this. I think it can put some people off, and they think, oh, this is not for me. I don't want to read about, you know, the queer experience. And I don't think that's helpful. Firstly, I think the whole point of fiction is sort of empathy and imagining a different life from your own, and the joy of that. But I also think that there is something universal in the human experience. And even when I'm writing about certain queer experiences, like coming out or like feeling ostracized or feeling like you don't belong, a lot of these things can be seen as very particular to the queer experience. But I do think that they also are universal in some ways. And everybody has felt versions of that. And so I think in good literature, you can feel those feelings, even if it's not your experience. But on the other hand, I do also want to write about queer people. I don't think there has been enough of that. And I think it's in both. I feel like there's almost two ways of doing that. And I try to do both of them. So the one is to try and write about kind of queer experiences specifically. And the other is to write stories which are just stories. And the characters happen to be queer people. And it's not a big deal. And it's not part of the story. Just so that people realize we're just like everybody else. You know, we're normal people. And we have lives like everybody else. Full of heartbreak and full of joy. And the whole range of human emotion is there. You asked me something about... Oh, how it intersects with other minorities, I suppose. That's also an interesting one. I think... When I was writing It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, I sort of, because I didn't do English literature for undergrad, I'm not an academic in like literature at all. I sort of realized after the fact by people telling me about it at events that I was championing intersectionality, and I hadn't really known that at the time. I was thinking, is it really weird that I'm writing a story about gay people in a climate apocalypse? Like, is that a strange thing to be writing about? The majority of whom were black characters as well. But I think there are ways in which there is a lot of shared experience in that. So obviously, kind of shared oppression in some ways. I think it's tricky. So as a white queer person in South Africa, I'm very privileged relative to a lot of other South Africans. And so I'm very conscious of that. And I try to grapple with that in my writing. But in other ways, I've been very much on the outside and very much excluded from, you know, the things that, I guess straight people in white society take for granted. I had a very, very unhappy time at boarding school, for example. I've had bad experiences because I'm queer. So it is a layered kind of thing. I think in some ways it's one of the minority experiences that's the loneliest growing up, because you don't really know about other queer people yet. And so you kind of feel like what's happening to you is just happening to you. Sorry, that's making me feel a bit emotional again. And there's also plenty about being queer that's worth celebrating. And there's a defiance that's I think, especially recently, I think there's quite a lot of defiance in the queer movement and people sort of not trying to blend in so much anymore and saying, we do things differently. We do things like this. But it is an intersectional thing. And I know this is the word for it. And there are ways in which, so when I write black queer characters, I was very nervous about that for my first book. And I think I am a very empathetic person. Maybe that comes from feeling like you're on the outside a lot of the time. But I try to put as much empathy and understanding into my characters as I could. And I try to imagine, like, these are the things I would feel in a situation like that. And now imagine I'm also, you know, a black person in Cape Town trying to do something moderately illegal, which one of the characters was doing at one point. You know, how would that make me feel? And so I guess I just try to really think about what it's like to have those additional layers as well as the queerness when I'm writing characters like that. But I did also get a sensitivity reader for that book in particular, because I was very nervous that I had got it wrong, or that I have a blind spot, or had missed something. So I just wanted to make sure that I hadn't.
And to what extent did that sensitivity reader intervene and make changes or suggest changes?
It was actually... Yeah, very luckily it wasn't a major change. They were pretty happy with it, actually. I had two people read it, and they were both thought I did an okay job of it. There were one or two things where they were like, it would feel a bit differently in this situation or this context. But thankfully it was a bit of a light edit.
I'm curious, because you explore it a little bit, so I'm curious, in the story, but also in reality, if you feel there's been a generational change in this, in how we approach writing queer characters, and also in the lived experience. Because as you're talking about coming out, I feel like Fiona and my children's experience, their generation, it's a bit different. I feel like they don't feel, I hope kids don't feel as alone as they used to. My feeling is certainly in my children's world, it's less, gay children are less isolated than they used to be. But talk to me about how you feel about that.
I agree. And I mean, I hope that's the case. I also have the sense that that's the case. And I do think it's patchy. I don't think everywhere in the world has reached that point. And there's also obviously now a very big backlash against all of this. But I do think in general, the kids growing up today have a much better time of it. And I don't think it's actually such a big deal to be queer anymore. As a teenager, you guys can tell me, you've got kids. I don't have kids, but I don't think it's a big deal, which is wonderful. And does put, like, I suppose my generation we're at a strange point in history, because I guess we have quite a lot of damage actually from our upbringings, but now it almost seems irrelevant, which is actually, it's a weird area, but I think it's maybe a fruitful area to explore. So that's why I've tried to write about it as well. And in terms of like the broader context, I do think there has been a shift. I think it was very much, gay rights, I guess when I was growing up, was very much about trying to get gay people included in sort of quote unquote normal life, so fighting for gay marriage, the characters in my book want to adopt a child. That was obviously also a huge deal at one point, whether you should allow gay people to adopt children. So trying to fight for the kinds of normal things that everybody else enjoys. And now I feel like it's the fight is maybe a bit different. So obviously now there's a lot more stuff around gender expression and gender identity and trans rights, but also of saying like, actually, we don't want that stuff. We're going to do things differently. So that's a kind of a different fight. And that queerness, because queerness has come back, that term, right?
Well, we weren't even allowed to say queer before. Exactly. Like, it was a very naughty word. If I'd used that growing up in that context, I would have been in big trouble with my very liberal parents.
Absolutely. Yeah, me too. Growing up, like, I was gay. That was what it was about. And queerness was like an insult.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it's like a lot of these words, you know, I'm not going to say them, but there are a lot of words where the group, I suppose, then reclaims them. So it was reclaimed. And so it is kind of like, I think queerness is different from gay rights because queerness is more defiant. And it's like, actually, we're not just going to try and do things the way everybody else does. And we're going to celebrate our difference. We're not going to try and like kill what's different between us. We're going to celebrate it.
So, Alistair, you have written a climate dystopian novel. You've written a contemporary novel that I would describe as literary. Mm-hmm. And now you've brought out a collection of short stories. What can readers look forward to in the future from you?
Lauren Bjerke said to me, I saw her in London last year. I was doing an event in London for The Child and she agreed to be the moderator for it, which is wonderful. But she told me that I basically have made all the worst career decisions you can make as a writer. I keep shooting myself in the foot. She's like, if you're going to bring out a speculative fiction book, you've got to do it after your literary book so that people respect you and read it. You've done it all the wrong way around. So I guess now I've made all those mistakes. But now, because there is a taste of all the different genres, I guess anything's possible. I didn't want to be pigeonholed as a speculative fiction writer. So I do think I'm going to write speculative fiction again in the future. I really enjoy it. But I don't want to only write that. So yeah, I guess I don't know what to expect. I've just started a new novel, but it's very early days and I don't know if it's going to work. So I don't know if I should talk about it, but it's actually sort of semi-speculative fiction again.
I'm quite interested in that statement that you've just started a new novel. Do you not start the moment you finish the last one?
No, I don't actually. I think I feel exhausted after I finish a creative project. And then again, well, I suppose maybe the writing maybe I suppose is different from the book being published. I do find all the social stuff, all the speaking gigs, quite exhausting. I find it quite hard to write when I'm in the stage of it, of all the launches and stuff. But yeah, I guess it's project by project, I suppose. I was working on, before The Child was even completely finished, I was already working on the stories for The Lucky Ones. But yeah, now I guess it was two quite soon after each other, two within 11 months, I think. And now I needed a bit of a break actually, and I wasn't sure how a short story collection was going to be received as well. So I was kind of almost waiting to see how that went, maybe to decide what my next move should be. But I do have, they're very early stages, and you know, when in the early stages, I don't really know if it's going to work or not. So, but I'm hoping it's going to work. The next novel I have, this might be a might derail our conversation a lot, but I have very severe anxiety about AI, and it really derails my creative process every now and then, to the point where it like stops me writing for months at a time, because I think, what's the point?
I know what I think you should do about that.
Yeah,
lean into it and write a dystopian AI novel. Yeah, okay. Ooh, I want to read that.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
You've talked about the two books in 11 months. It's like Irish twins in books. I'm interested. It feels to me like you've burst onto the South African literary scene, like unheard of, and then suddenly heard of everywhere, everyone's talking about you and you're all over social media and in full color. You haven't just quietly slipped in there. you've come in there. How has that felt for you?
I mean, amazing. I wasn't expecting it. It's been really incredible. And it is, yeah, I don't know. I suppose it is. I suppose it was kind of bursting onto the scene, but it felt like it was also, maybe not gradual is the right word, but it definitely felt like I can feel with each successive book that maybe more people know about me and more people, the launch that I did for the Lucky Ones at the Book Lounge a couple of weeks ago was, I was really touched by how many people showed up for it. And I felt kind of, I mean, it sounds, does it say terrible to say like you've made it? But like, it's almost like this has been a dream of mine for so long. And now there are people in the room who I don't know personally. They're not friends of mine who feel like they should come to an event. They're just there because they like my work. Mm. And that just felt absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
I think that is one of the measures of, I've made it a little bit, that when there's strangers in your audience, there's something about that.
Because I go to book launches all the time and did long before I brought out a book. And obviously I would just go to a book launch because I like the writer. So it's amazing to think that now there are people doing that because I'm on, like, I don't know, the mailing list or whatever. You know, it's incredible.
It's a lovely feeling.
Yeah.
So Alistair, what have you been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression?
So I'm in two book clubs, and both of my book clubs are the kind where we all have to read the same book. So I have limited say over what I get to read. So I try and read three books a month so that I also have choice over one of them. We vote for what we're reading in book club. But so sometimes I read some quite unexpected stuff. And we're reading for one of my book clubs, Butter, at the moment, she's a Japanese author. Her name, I'm going to have to check it again, is Asoko Yuzuki. I don't think I've ever actually read a book by a Japanese author that I don't love. So I just kind of agreed to it based purely on that. I don't know what it is. Maybe the ones that make it into translation into English are just the top, the very best. I wonder if it's also maybe that it's their whole sort of canon and like literary tradition is just so different from ours that it's so refreshing. It's like storytelling in a different way. This is about a woman who strikes up a relationship with a woman who's in prison for murdering her husband's by exchanging recipes with her. So it's kind of like,
sounds nice.
Yeah. And it's, and she writes about food a lot in it. So it's a kind of a book about a woman who murdered all her husbands. And then also there's all these recipes that make me really hungry while I'm reading it. So I've been really enjoying that. The last kind of very controversial book I read that I loved was All Fours by Miranda July, which I know some people loathed. Okay, yeah.
Gail loathed, I loved.
Yeah, you can't feel lukewarm about that book. And then I just read a book for a launch that I did 2 weeks ago by a debut South African author called Saltwater Pool Boy, which I thought was really, really beautiful. Peter Adrian Altini, about a boy growing up in Cape Town and his mother's terminally ill and then what happens with his life moving to Rome. And I've been in a bit of a crisis with TV since White Lotus ended. I loved White Lotus. And since that ended, I haven't really known what to do with myself. So I've been doing a bunch of reruns, been watching some old Frasier, which I find very comforting. I've just started watching, what's it called? The Studio. You guys seen The Studio?
Oh, I'm watching it now.
Oh, yes.
Love it.
It's so great.
I'm obsessed.
It's so awkward, but I love it. Yeah. It's just so good. Yeah.
There's a series called Sirens, which has just started, which apparently is quite White Lotus vibes.
Okay.
So that might interest you.
Okay, that's good. I love that kind of TV where you don't really like any of the characters, but you just can't look away for some reason. Mm-hmm. Like I love Succession and all of these shows, you know. Listening to your guys' podcast.
Oh,
that's the perfect answer.
Well, Alistair, we hope everyone checks out your backlist and most particularly rushes out now and buys The Lucky Ones, your short story collection, because it's wonderful and they are guaranteed to enjoy it. But thank you so much for coming in today. We really appreciate your time. This has been great.
Thank you so much, Alistair. I've loved this.
Well, thank you so much for having me, guys. I loved it too. So nice chatting to you both.
Gail, I know we both feel incredibly energized after that interview with Alistair, and we're dying to leap up and go and do something about it.
I felt like the way Alistair talks about writing, the kind of conversation that I love listening to in a podcast, I hope our listeners have enjoyed it, where I feel like afterwards I want to go and write. I remember why I write. I remember what energizes me about writing. And I want to go and write. Maybe Alistair is what I needed to get out of my writing slump.
Let's hope.
How do you think my husband would feel if I asked Alistair to move in with us and shout at me from the sidelines? Fiona, what did you take out of that particularly?
Well, this idea of using the notes app on your phone to capture ideas, I know it's not absolutely the first time I've ever heard that, but this is really sticking in my brain now, and I think I need to do it. Because hearing Alistair say that, on top of hearing John Boyne say in our previous season that this is something that he does, I let ideas flit into my brain and flit out again. And I think I need to capture them. I need to pull out my butterfly net and capture them and make a record of them. Even if maybe I don't remember exactly what I meant by that or don't quite know why that inspired me so much. But John also talked about going back to his list of ideas and picking one. You know, you've, Gail, so often talked about the ideas tree at the bottom of your garden and going out and picking an idea. Well, this could be a real ideas tree. You write down all your ideas and then you go back and you think, oh, okay, I feel like doing this one today.
So I agree with you in a way, but I also have experience of it not working. So I have a bit of a fantasy about having a notepad in my car because I often think of things when I'm driving. So the other day when we were driving to the podcast, I drove past a pawn shop, and then in the space between the pawn shop and the podcast studio, wrote most of a short story in my head. I got to the studio, I grabbed a piece of paper, I wrote, "Sells wedding ring at pawn shop" on the piece of paper. And I was like, ah, captured you, got the butterfly in the net, put it in my diary. Fiona, I have got no clue what that sentence means. I don't know what that great story I wrote in my head is. I know it was magnificent, but I have no idea what that sentence means. So I'd have to write quite a lot to capture the feeling. And I wonder if for me, I can do it because of my wonky memory. And because I almost feel like I should have immediately raced home and vomited that story out, that I can't leave a pause. But that's not realistic as well. So I don't know. I don't know. But I think you're right. Becoming more intentional about writing ideas down is the start.
Okay. So we're going to catch some butterflies from now on. We're going to give it a try.
Let's report back to each other.
And Gail, what did you get from what Alistair said?
I was very taken with the thing that he had taken from somebody else about if you haven't got 100 rejections for the year, you haven't worked hard enough. And I do think it's very real. I think getting rejections is part of the game. I mean, anyone who's been in this, doing this for a while, we know you get rejected by agents, you get rejected by publishers, you get rejected for short stories, you get rejected for everything. You can't take it personally. But it does show you getting yourself out there. I think I'm not putting, particularly in the short story sphere, I'm not doing it enough. I'm not putting it out there enough. And that maybe I should, because we know I love a goal. I love a deadline. I love a, you have to read 10 books in the next 10 days or whatever the thing is. So maybe I need to have a, I have to have 10 short story rejections. I'm not aiming for 100. I'm only human. Maybe that's a way to think about writing goals that's a little bit different. And also it's lovely because then your rejection isn't just a rejection. It's also a thing on your tick list.
Yes. Like,
oh, yay, another rejection. Closer to my goal.
So this sounds like something else that we need to report back to each other about.
Oh, goodness, so much homework, Fiona, so much homework.
Well, if you are one of the thousands of people who have read and enjoyed Alistair Mackay's works, if you have tried any of the advice that he has given us today, if anything is working particularly well for you this week, please get in touch with us. We're on all social media across the board and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.